Blog Talk Radio.
The whole liberation of oppressed people in the United States has to do not with climbing up some ladder to success, not for asking to be just like Rockefeller or just like DuPont or just like Ford, because that would only continue the oppression and exploitation of oppressed people in the United States, and specifically African people born and raised in the United States. Socialism is an integral part of building social justice on this planet. The condition of my people, my history, was very much connected with other oppressed people, and I began to see that the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck. And so I began to understand that imperialism has to go. It is a poison that is killing people all over this world. The priorities of this planet have to be completely changed. And instead of profits, instead of policies that destroy the earth, that destroy the water, that destroy human beings, I believe a policy that protects people, that makes people live in a community, a world community, that's what I believe. That's my basic political commitment at this moment.
Out in the streets, they call it murder.
Where the thugs them can bat. Two pound a weed in a van box. It's in a your handbag. Your knapsack, it's in a your backpack. The smell of your girlfriend contact. Come boy, not know this. Them only come around like tourists on the beach with a few club sodas. Bedtime stories and pose like them name Chuck Norris. And don't know the real hardcore, cause sandals are not back to. The thugs them we do where them got to. And voting twice to shot to. Don't make them spot to. Unless you carry guns a lot to. A beer tough thing come at you. When trench town man stop laugh and block off traffic. Then them we learn pop off and them start drop it. With the pin pile long and it a beat drop it. Police come in a jeep and them can't stop it. Some say them a playboy rabbit. Get chopped like a bad habit. Son of a the post office, you're down to it. Rastafari stands alone. Pure ghosts and phantom. The youth them get blind by stardom. Now the king of kings a call. Whole man to pick me. So wave on no one if you with me. To see this operation sick me. Them suit not fit me. To win election them trick with. Then them down do nothing at all. Come on, let's face it. I get our education's basic. And most of the youth them waste it. And when them waste it, that's when them take the guns, replace it. Then them don't stand a chance at all. And that's why enough little youth have up some fatmatic. With the extra magazine in a them back pocket. And a bleach at night time in a some black jacket. All who not lock black said them a lock rocket. Then we pull the up a current like a shock socket. Then we run a road block with but the cops block it. And from now till a man in a stop clock it. If them run out around a rock back rocket. Southside, Northside. East Coast, West Coast. Yo. Cornwall, Middle Sex and Surrey, y'all. Hey.
Out in the street, they call it murder.
Jamaica, Jamaica. Jamaica, Jamaica. Jamaica, Jamaica. Jamaica, Jamaica. Jamaica, Jamaica.
1967, at Tougaloo College on the outskirts of Jackson, Mississippi, Stokely Carmichael, who popularized the term black power, lashed out against the war in Vietnam. This speech followed just days after an appearance at Nashville, which prompted riots by students at Fisk and Tennessee A&I universities. 3 days after Tougaloo, Carmichael participated in mass rallies of anti-war supporters in New York and San Francisco. Born in Trinidad on July 29, 1941, Carmichael became an American citizen when his parents came to the U.S. and were naturalized. He was still in college in 1960 when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, was formed. It was SNCC which organized the sit-ins in the South. In 1966, as its leader, Carmichael spent a year transforming the organization toward the concerns of black college students. This speech, given to about 700 students, illustrates the clear division between traditional nonviolent civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King and the more militant leaders coming on the scene. Here the viewer can see Carmichael define America's racial problems. Note particularly his concern with semantics and his use of antithesis to contrast the black and white perspective. Also noteworthy, of course, is his ability to excite and motivate his audience. At one point, he leads the audience in a chant, which, though abbreviated on this tape, lasted 10 minutes. In all, the viewer can witness an example of confrontational rhetoric from the 60s, illustrated by the fiery Stokely Carmichael.
I'm trying to figure out which one belongs to the CIA. Nick? It was once one of the only places we could run to for safety when we started to work in Mississippi in 1961 and 62. So that it's sort of like coming home when we come back to Tougaloo. Now, I want you to, before I begin, to take a look at all of the pressmen before you. You will notice that not one of them are black. And they are going to have the nerve tomorrow to call me a racist. Are you with me? Understand how the honkies are, they don't recognize their own racism. I understand that I'm following the great white father, Bobby Kennedy. I understand last night he told you a couple of things. Now I want to put some of them in perspective for you. When he said the world belongs to you, that comes from a great black man by the name of Frederick Douglass. He said the world belongs to you. Bobby urged us to stand up and speak out against injustice. Well, we could tell him that we don't need anybody to tell us to stand up anymore. Not only are we going to stand up, we're going to right the wrongs of our people in this generation. Our generation has the memories of the unpunished murders of Schwerney, Goodney, and of Medgar Evers. There are going to be no more unpunished murders. They've been telling you that the kids in Nashville started a riot. Number one, you ought to recognize it is not a riot, it is a rebellion. A rebellion. And number two, you ought to be proud of your black brothers and sisters at Fifth, because a honky cop touched one of them and they told him you got to touch all of us.
You're quite hostile.
I got a right to be hostile, man. My people been persecuted.
I keep it away, of course, and I'm keeping you from sleeping. And on the stage I raise and I'm rolling. And to the poor I pour in all my metaphors. I'm not bluffing, it's nothing that we ain't did before. We played to say the points made, you consider it done by the prophet the rage.
Oh, the people say,
yo, Flip, you're next one step, you get to the east side. We got to kick it for the east side, see?
I roll with the punches so I survive.
I survive.
Try to rock cause it keeps the crowd alive.
Crowd alive.
I'm not falling,
falling.
I'm just calling.
Falling.
But I pass the days of yes, y'all.
Hey yo, Chris, we got to get to my man Ralph in the south. I'm kicking to the south side.
I ring your bell, can
hostile.
May I say something to you to give you a true knowledge of yourself and life, so that the same glory and success attained by other men who understand themselves may be yours? Man in the full knowledge of himself is a superb and supreme creature of creation. When man becomes possessor of the knowledge of himself, he becomes master of his environment, the captain of his own ship, the director of his own destiny, the accomplisher of his own end. Man should understand himself because man is full of knowledge, and this knowledge is a gift of nature. When Mother Nature created man, she deprived him of nothing. He was given the faculty of understanding all things around him. This faculty for understanding has not been taken away from him. None of his senses have been taken away from him. So there is no excuse for the black man in lacking the knowledge that man is used to unify the world and produce all that he needs for his happiness and civilization. Look the world over and whatever you see in it that is pleasing to man, contributing to man's comfort, to his needs and to his satisfaction, it is but the work of man. Man left with the knowledge of himself and the understanding of all things around him. If you are able to live with the knowledge of yourself and with the greater knowledge of nature, you must know what is good and what is not. You must know what is finite. You must know that which is material, physical, and otherwise is at your disposal to create or otherwise use. If we leave America and go over to the east of Japan, they will be telling their fellow citizens of Japan of the wonderful accomplishments of the Japanese people, proving that man is moving onward as time moves on. But you have created yourselves as you have done in previous years. You have shown malice, prejudice, and hate to each other. And the result is that while other races have made progress, while India has made progress towards nationalism, while Maryland has made progress towards republicanism, while the whole world has made progress in man's accomplishments, you still stand fighting yourself, dishonoring yourself, showing no disposition toward a higher life, so that you will be abundantly better. So reflect and take that you were created for some purpose other than exhibiting malice toward your neighbor or fellow men of your own race. What a pity it is if we cannot stand united without the written law. There is no written law compelling other races to stand together. They are brought together by the gentle touch of nature. The unwritten law of nature causes them to stand together in all of these sons. So wheresoever you find them in the field, that one gentle touch of nature causes them to stand together, if need be, die together. But with the black man, you can preach to him from the pulpits, you lecture from the platform, from the byways and the hedges. The spirit of cooperation, but evil not cooperate. You talk to him gently, you try talking harshly, then he still will not cooperate. The result is that false praise to those who understand themselves and walk through the world making their serfs and slaves. You must acquire an understanding of yourself, around yourself. See the smiling pictures of nature, the beautiful hedges, the wonderful mountains, the wonderful vegetation all around. But because of your disposition to each other, you live in suffering, in want, in penury, and in debt. You lack the gentle touch of nature, love for each other, you hate yourselves. Black men and black men, and what is wrong with you? Why have you no affection for yourselves? But I hope to see you living among yourselves and the people I've spoken of, living in charity, love, and in sympathy with each other. It can be done. I wonder if you will adapt that course. Isn't it easier to enjoy prosperity than to live in ignorance and darkness? Why say that you work with the nature? Nature never gave pain, suffering, and death to the world. It was man himself who selected death, pain, and suffering. I wonder if I cannot inspire you to select between good and evil. Let me impress upon you once again that whatsoever your hardships may be, whatsoever your difficulties in life, they are your own selection. And so if you encourage them, if you husband them and take them to your bosom, they will abide with you.
Yo, turn this motherfucking shit up.
Big nose and lips, big hips and butt dancing. What? me and the rest of my fam. Try to infiltrate and murder off the best of my clan. I'm not American, punk, Democrat, or Republican. Remember that. Most of the cats we know be hustling. My mama worked all her life and still struggling. I blame it on the government and say it on the radio. And if you don't already know, all these Uncle Tom ass kissing niggas got to go.
Brothers have gained their independence faster than you and I here in America have. They've also gained recognition and respect as human beings much faster than you and I. Just 10 years ago on the African continent, our people were colonized. They were suffering all forms of colonization, oppression, exploitation, degradation, humiliation, discrimination, and every other kind of Asian. And in a short time, they have gained more independence, more recognition, more respect as human beings than you and I have. And you and I live in a country which is supposed to be the citadel of education, freedom, justice, democracy, and all of those other pretty sounding words. We want freedom by any means necessary. We want justice by any means necessary. We want equality by any means necessary. We don't feel that in 1964, living in a country that is supposedly based upon freedom and supposedly the leader of the free world, we don't think that we should have to sit around and wait for some segregationist congressmen and senators and a president from Texas in Washington, D.C. to make up their mind that our people are due now some degree of civil rights. No, we want it now or we don't think anybody should.
I got loyalty inside my DNA. Cocaine quarter piece got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though ambition flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, and sworn like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, which yells you a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your fucking head. This that puts the kids to bed. This that I got realness. I just kill shit cause it's in my DNA. I got millions, I got riches building in my DNA. I got dark, I got evil that rot inside my DNA. I got off, I got trouble, some heart inside my DNA. I just win again, like Wimbledon I serve. Yeah, that's him again, the sound, the engine in is like a bird. You see fireworks, the Corvette tire skirt, the boulevard. I know how you work, I know just who you are. See, use a bitch, your hormones probably switch inside your DNA. Problem is, all that sucker shit inside your DNA. Offend you, this is Parler's oldest son. I know murder, conviction, furnace, boosters, burglars, ballers, dead, redemption, scholars, fathers, dead, with kids and I wish I was fed. Forgiveness, yeah. Soldier's DNA, born inside the beast. My expertise checked out in second grade. When I was 9, on sale motel, we didn't have nowhere to stay. At 29, I've been so well, hit cartwheel in my estate. And I'm gon' shine like I'm supposed to. Antisocial, extrovert, and excellent mean an extra work. And absentness, what the fuck you heard? Struck my nerve, and that's a riff gonna be this case. The reason my power's here on earth. Salute the truth and the prophecy. I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA.
This is why
DNA.
I say that hip-hop has done more damage to young African-Americans than racism in recent years.
I live about my DNA.
This
is my heritage, all I'm inheriting. Money and power, the maker, I'm emeritus. Tell me something, you motherfuckers can't tell me nothing. I'd rather die than to listen to you. My DNA not for imitation. Your DNA an abomination. This how it is when you in the matrix. Out your bullets, reaping what you're sowing. Stacking up the footage, living on the go and sleeping in the pillar. Sipping from a Grammy, walking in the building. Diamond in the ceiling, marble on the floor. Beaches out the window, peeking out the window. Baby in the pool, Godfather calls. Only Lord knows I've been going hammer. Dodger paparazzi, freaking through the cameras. Eat it for a daughter's rock, wearing sandals. Yoga on the Monday, stretching to the banner. Watching all the snakes. Curving all the fake phone, never own. I don't camera stand, I don't compromise. I just penetrate, sex, money, murder. These are the breaks, these are the times. Level number 9, look up in the sky. Tennis on the way, tennis on the way, tennis on the way. Motherfucker, I got winners on the way. You ain't shit without a buddy on your belt. You ain't shit without a ticket on your plate. You ain't sick enough to put it on yourself. You ain't rich enough to hit the ladder gate. Tell me when destruction gonna be my fate. Gonna be a fake, gonna be a fake. Peace to the world, let it rotate. Sex, money, murder, I do.
Tupac Shakur is a child of the 60s. Tupac Shakur, born come out of the spirit of the revolution of the 60s. Tupac Shakur. Fire in his bones. Huh? Boldness and rebellion in his blood. Born from his beautiful, bold Black Panther mama, Afeni. Sitting in the jail cell, a revolutionary woman carrying the fruit of life. Mocking the child in her womb. Mocking the child with rebellion. Mocking the child with insurrection. Mocking the child with a spirit to not go along with what's been going on. When you got a generation like that, you've got to work with them. You've got to mold them and shape them and fashion them.
To our program for the future.
Right now, it's extremely supporting of the president and his policy.
FBI scientists have found chemical traces consistent with a bomb or a missile on a piece of wreckage. Police using clubs and tear gas against demonstrators.
So and a white fascist. Like they said, you're getting some of your own medicine.
You can't fool all the people all of the time, but if you fool the right one, then the rest will fall behind. Tell me who's got control of your mind, your worldview. Is it the news or the movie you taking your girl to? Know what I'm saying, cause Uncle Sam got a plan. If you examine what they telling us, then you will understand what they planting in the seeds of the next generation. Feeding our children miseducation. No one knows if there's UFOs or any life on Mars, or what they doing when they up in the stars. Because I don't believe a word of what the president said. He's filling our heads with lies, got us hypnotized when he be speaking in cold words about crime and poverty, drugs, welfare, prisons, guns, and robbery. It really means us. There's no excuse for the slander, but what's good for the group is still good for the gander, see.
I don't believe Bob Marley got me cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't want no computer chip in my arm. I don't want to die by a nuclear bomb. I say we all rush the Pentagon. Pull out guns and grab the intercom. My first words would be, I believe man made God. Out of ignorance and fear, if God made man, then why the hell would he put us here? I thought he supposed to be the all-loving, the same God who let Hitler put the Jews in the ovens. We don't fall for the regular shit. They try to feed us all this half-ass leadership. Different position, they turn politician and shut the hell up and follow tradition. Boy, your TV screen is telling lies to your vision. Every channel got some brainwashed cop shit to watch. Running up in niggas' cribs claiming that they earned shots. It's a plot. But Buster, can you tell me who's greedier? The big corporations, the pigs or the media? Sign of the time, terrorism on the rise. Commercial airplanes falling out the skies like flies. Make me wonder what secrets went down with Ron Brown, who burned the churches to the ground with no evidence found. It's not coincidence. It's been too many steady incidents. It could have been the Klan who put that bomb at the Olympics, but it probably was the FBI. Deep at the core, cause if they make us all panic, they can start martial law. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed you because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. You killed Huey because you knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is motherfucking propaganda.
That they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletariat. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pig. The people are going to have to stand up against the pig. That's what the pastors are doing. That's what the pastors are doing all over the world.
Fred.
This is Black Power, Black Power, Black Nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People Tuesday weekly night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Nat Turner, co-host, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, myself, and our engineers on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communication, Sister Amina. Calling each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, the betrayal of Dr. King. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chair, Nat Turner. Yuhuru, Black Power, all power to the people, comrade. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You can hear me, brother?
Black Power, loud and clear. Mm-hmm.
All right, on Black Power, all power to the people. Yeah, we want to do this show in regards to the last week's Martin Luther King holiday, which is, of course, a national holiday now, and put on the national calendar. There's others of us who, I guess, take a more militant position along the lines of Malcolm X. But what we want to do is make this, this contrast, this transformation or transformation in progress, the latter stage Dr. Martin Luther King as opposed to the early stage Dr. Martin Luther King. And we want to put that in perspective because those who celebrate the man every year on this holiday and keep alive his, his vision or his dream, or I don't even know if the dream is fulfilled or whatever, or is damn near there or whatever. We're still struggling. But those who want to keep, his message, constantly quote him, they go to speak to our young people at schools and whatnot, give speeches at the college, talk about, the civil rights struggle and today's fight for justice and equality and whatnot. We feel that there's a betrayal on their part. And then if there's 10 of them in the room, maybe at least one of them has, exposed our people or those who they've had a chance to speak to about the latter stage of Dr. King. There are some now modern day civil rights activists, whatever you want to call it, activists general, or may have taken on a more radical, militant posture. of course, the younger blood that always has to step in into an organization in order for that organization to stay alive or stay afloat or to keep functioning, and we want to get into that. The Martin Luther King that rose up in the South, family background and whatnot. there's a Martin Luther King Jr., and there must have, of course, been a Martin Luther King Sr. And a lot of this is... I'm going to try to take my time. There's so many things that's going through my mind right now, but try to get it out and know, to you know, make our point here. There's certain, I guess, involvement, certain type of class structure, you know, in the midst of, or the black collective experience here in this country. You know, those of us who after physical slavery, who managed to gain some type of education, went on to go to higher education, higher learning, college. Some of these institutions were founded for the upliftment of black people, which have now become historically known as, you know, or historically black colleges and universities and whatnot. And there have been those who have went through that, through that channel, and have you know, achieved success. There's a book written by Lawrence Otis Graham. Lawrence Otis Graham, I remember seeing him years ago, before Hurricane America. And for those of you who don't know what Hurricane America is, that is what the populace referred to as Hurricane Katrina. There's a talk show used to come on called Donahue, and you know, he had his moments where he would have, you know, these persons, you know, who were considered as radicals and militants, and you know, they were controversial, you know. And there's always a thing when black people talk about some serious shit and we're telling the truth, they, you know, they got to be controversial. It's amazing. But remember him having this little dude on there, and you know, he's speaking, you know, the top notch, you know, Queen's English, you know. Those of us who believe that that's some type of status symbol, you know, it proves to white people that we smart too, you know, that we're just as eloquent as them in speech, you know, that we speak well and we don't speak broken English. Broken English is supposed to be this indication of illiteracy or low IQ. You know, all the superficial bullshit, you know, that goes along with that. And instead of just simply being yourself or a human being, you know. But this little dude, you know, I'm saying it like that, you know, that the way we speak sometimes. And but you know, he was on that and that, and he was speaking, and he was talking about Wall Street or something, you know. And he was he, you know, gives this impression that he, you know, that he infiltrated Wall Street, or he you know, he went to Wall Street to, you know, get the experience of a white male patriarchal rule, you know, the rich white ruling class and whatnot, you know. And he said he went there and got him a job, I think as a waiter or something like that, just to get in. And, you know, listening to him, you know, you think he was exposing some shit, you know, and talking about, you know, wealth and power, you know. And I was trying to make sense of the whole thing. I was trying to figure out, like, where was he going with it? You know, it was like, okay, we're going to overthrow, you know, these old white men, you know, terms like honky, cracker, and stuff. Those terms from a very lopsided affair, or a very brutal relationship, you know, with the white ruling class. And so, you know, we use those terms in the black militant circles, you know, and even, you know, just in general sometimes, you know, black people, you know, collectively in their anger and their disappointment. But these terms are not used loosely. You know, these terms are not used, you know, just for the fuck of it. You know, we just talking out the side of our ass or nothing like that. We use the term due to an experience because of a relationship, you know. But he's trying to, again, you know, get his whole point here. You know, okay, you're telling us that, you know, they're prejudiced and, you know, they don't give a damn about nobody but themselves. So what, we overthrow them or what, you know? Are we going to try to beg and plead for them to let us be their equals? You know, equality, you know, this thing that came out of the 60s about justice and equality and shit, you know, the injustice that is still inflicted upon us after 500 years of being on this side of the planet. But, you know, years later, you know, this Lawrence Otis Graham dude had, you know, he told a story. You know, he didn't come up, you know, went to school, college, whatnot, made it. And years later, he talked about how he had become part of this group, you know, and he wrote about it, you know, years later. And he called this book, it actually has two, but there's one book that I had got my hands on. It's called Our Kind of People, Inside America's Black Upper Class. Mm-hmm. And so he writes, you know, about the who's who in this book. And he goes back, he gives you a history. And he goes back into a history of the who's who and whatnot. And it sort of ties all these things in together. And when you read the book and you look and you see the names and stuff, it start, you know, you have to start wondering, you know, exactly what is their purpose, you know, what are their goal is and stuff. And he has, like I said, he has these, you know, the names. And these are the same people who have been made to be famous or have become our so-called leaders in the civil rights movement. And these groups or these clubs that they belong to, and even their children, you know, where they create a little club for the children, you know, the cahoot and you know, fraternize one another and stuff. So it's like a camp, it's like a breeding ground, you know, it's like a, you know. And he mentions you know, the King family, you know, and, you know, Martin Luther King, and how these individuals, these persons that went to these black colleges in Atlanta, you know, Spelman, Morehouse, and so forth. And one of these universities, one of these colleges, you know, I would wonder about, like, where did they get these names of these colleges? You know, like, you know, what is a Morehouse, and, you know, what is a Spelman, you know? Of course, you know, you look at the name and, you know, you see two words, you know, like spell and man, so forth, you know. But this particular university was actually named after the wife of John D. Rockefeller. And John D. Rockefeller was the patriarch of the rich Rockefeller family that has had his hands in just about everything in this country, from politics to economics, you know, so forth, to banking, to industry, commerce, you know, you name it, you know, wars, and so forth. You know, and so this universe is set up after the name of his wife, Laura Spelman. And, you know, I want to, you know, just give a vivid picture, you know, where we going with this, you know, from this person to this transformed person, you know, color it in. But, you know, the people over the years who had become like the first black governor of Virginia, you know, Douglas Wilde and all these people, or the first black songs, and you know, you start asking yourself, like, you know, well, damn, is this a coincidence? You know, all these individuals who have been selected who made history, you know, what I refer to as feel-good history, you know, feel-good history and actual reality and change is not the same thing. You know, one is used to serve the other, you know, designed to keep, you know, black people in the same position, you know, which is a Machiavellian tactic, but at the same time, appease them from time to time, you know, to keep them in a dependent state, you know, in a almost a comatose state, you know, and so to craft and build and mold and make leadership, or to be able to get ahead of, you know, anticipating the future, you know, after physical slavery, you know, 1863, you know, and of course, you know, 1865, Juneteenth, you know. But to anticipate the future, knowing that all the wrongs that had been committed, you know, by the white dominant group, and the laws of nature would soon one day visit upon that group. Like some know it in the scripture, you know, the sins, something about the sins of the father shall visit upon the children or something like that. And this comment that, to my understanding, that George Washington had made as something to the effect of, he had the nerve enough to say God in the first place, you know, with something about I tremble or shudder or something like that, knowing that God is just, because that's what he was talking about, you know. And so they anticipate the future, and that one day that this black mass would rise up and exact revenge, you know, on the dominant group that had held it in a position of servitude using violence. You know, using all forms of control, you know. And so on into the 1880s and 90s and, you know, beginning of the 20th century and so forth. And then, you know, these certain forces had done just that. You know, they were able to, you know, craft, you know, this black leadership thing. If there was going to be one, then they made sure that they would be the ones that be the orchestrators of it, the architects of it, you know. So, you know, individuals like Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and, you know, they had their debate, whatnot, and going back and forth. of course, you know, you had, you know, Frederick Douglass, who had said, you know, in so many ways that, black people ain't gonna get shit, you know, without getting their hands and knees dirt. That they wanted rain without thunder, and they wanted to read the cries without getting, you know, their knees dirt. You know, and you know, the 20th century kicked into the stages of A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, who they recently made a movie about. Using the same black dude who played in Walking Dead. And I believe this dude is gay in real life. I think he's actually gay in real life, because he also played, you know, a gay role on Walking Dead, you know. But, you know, Bayard Rustin and A. Philip Randolph, I remember that, you know, coming up as a little boy, you know, about A. Philip Randolph. And I thought that A. Philip Randolph was, like, real militant, you know, and he has a group, the Brotherhood of the Sleeping called Porters or something like that. And that his first march on Washington was orchestrated by him, you know. And, you know, he was projected towards as real militant. So that shit, you know, it had appeal. You know, it appealed to me, you know. And during the same period, you know, the 40s and the 50s, you had another minister. His name was Vernon Jones. And Vernon Jones had been the minister of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And you know, some consider him the pioneer of the civil rights movement. And there was a militancy about him. You know, it was a movie made by him, as a matter of fact. And this movie was produced by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was formerly known as Lew Alcindor back in the 60s when he played basketball, NBA basketball, for the Milwaukee Bucks before he had become or got traded to the Los Angeles Lakers and became known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, become an Orthodox Muslim. And Kareem himself had these transformations of self, you know, and that was one of them. But the other transformation, when he said it took a trip to Israel, and he was shocked, you know, to see the type of treatment that one group of Jews could do to another group of Jews, or so-called Jews, you know, could do to another group of Jews. And he was talking about the white Jews, how they was treating the black Jews, who were known as the Beta Israel Jews, who had got airlifted from Ethiopia, I think back in the 80s or the 90s or something like that, Operation King Solomon or some shit, you know. And, you know, he was shocked to see the treatment, you know, that they received, you know, the type of racism. And so I don't know if that sparked him or his consciousness or whatever. We made a movie about Vernon Jones. And in this movie, he portrays Vernon Jones, or not he portrays, but in the movie, Vernon Jones can be seen as a militant. You know, he carried a big stick, a big old large piece of wood that he carved, and he kept it with him in his car. And he was a militant. And so he was so militant that the church deacons and all these other people who, I guess, on his board or whatever, you know, they had grown a bit worried, you know, about his message, you know. And before too long, they got rid of him. You know, he was pushed out, you know, and they, you know, called themselves trying to find another minister, and they came upon this young minister who had a way with words, you know, eloquent speech, you know, he was a good orator, whatever you want to call it. And they thought he was the perfect replacement for Vernon Jones, you know. And I don't know how accurate this part is, but near the end, when they show him, he start, you know, on his journey to becoming the world famous Martin Luther King, and he was giving his sermon, and he showed one of the deacons or whatever, like shaking his head, like, "Lord, we done got rid of one, and only to get another who you know, who going in this direction." I don't know how true that is, you know, but I remember that at the end of this movie. And so that's the beginning of Dr. Martin Luther King in the ministry, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Alabama. And of course, Alabama was one of the, you know, deep south, you know, along the southern belt of the Delta. You know, sheer, broad, brutal, naked racism and violence, you know, the lynchings, you know, and so forth. In Alabama, of course, Alabama had its historic moments, you know, and so forth. And, you know, learning these things, and there's a brother who had been in our midst for some time, in more recent times, you know, in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s, whatnot, named Steve Coakley. And started, you know, watching some of his, you know, speeches of what, it was kind of hard to say that the man was giving a speech. It was more like political education class, you know, actually trying to help black people to some people who look just like us, who was in bed with the enemy, you know, who was willing to go along with the conditions of things, you know what I'm saying? And he began to expose us to what was referred to as the Brule. And so we was like, okay, the Brule, all right. And it didn't sound too good, you know. And, you know, this thing about the talent intent, you know, got into the picture. And I remember that when I was in high school. It may have been middle school, you know, being taught about that in the class or when they talked about W.E. Du Bois or Black History Month, you know. And it started adding up. You start realizing that we you know, we're spinning this wheel that's going to keep spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. But our collective conditions don't change, you know. And so this is what Coakley was exposing us to. And he went to naming names, and you know, you'd be like, "Damn!" And that Dr. King name came up, and I done heard his speeches. He's listened to these Malcolm X speeches, you know, and just the pieces just started falling in place, you know. And what Coakley would say in one way, Malcolm was saying, had been saying in another way about something referred to as the Big Six. And, you know, one of those is Dr. King, A. Philip Randolph, and a couple of more, some other people. And so this timeline from the 1900s, you know, to the 60s, you know, like 60 years. And all in there, you know, you see this structure, like, you know, this pattern structure. And all the individuals who had been this part of this pattern structure is the same individuals who Lawrence Otis Graham mentions in this book, Our Kind of People. And, you know, proudly, you know, 99% of them, not all of them. You know, and the more you think about it, the more and more you realize that the streets, you know, is going to stay the streets, that the reality of the collective black masses of black people couldn't change under this type of structure, that we could only be given concessions, you know, token appeal. And so it dawned on me why, you know, Governor Douglas Wilder, or Douglas Wilder was made the first black governor of Virginia. And then some went, took that shit even further, said, yeah, you know, a light-skinned, curly-haired black man, you know, mixed light-skinned, you know, and so forth, you know. And just one after the next, you know, one after the next and shit. You know, and when the 50s come around, and some young people had decided they had enough of that shit. You know, they decided they had enough of the treatment of black people by these vicious whites who refuse to acquiesce to their own law. You know, the so-called, however that shit go, you know, this constitutional right. And they, you know, they shitted on it every chance they got. You know, it wasn't worth nothing to them when it came to non-whites. It was everything in the world to them when it was just the whites interacting with one another. You know? So, in North Carolina, you know, young people had decided that they weren't going to be denied anymore. And so that's what, you know, started the sit-ins, you know. That's what that started the sit-ins and stuff. And some of them are college students. And they decided that more important to fight for their equal treatment or equality than going to college and, you know, getting a degree and living a, you know, a nice, comfortable lifestyle. They felt that it was more important that they step forward and started the shit. And these were pretty much no-name people in a sense. You know, they hadn't had the big-time audience and whatnot, you know, as they fell around off. And, of course, Malcolm X was stepping into the picture, Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, you know. And that is how that started. And, of course, you know, you had Rosa Parks who refused to give up a seat in the front of the bus. But there was a sister before Rosa Parks. And her name all, you know, slips my mind. You know, and even that in itself was based on class, to my understanding. That Rosa Parks had come from a more affluent family and that they decided to make Rosa Parks the face of the civil rights movement based on her actions. And I can't make this up. These are the things that triggered, you know, the rise of Martin Luther King. You know, of course, in the 60s, in the urban so-called environment, the hood, the Black Panther Party referred to as the Occupied Colony, you know, shit was always brewing, the rage and the frustration. You know, the disappointment that black people have felt collectively toward the government, you know, while criticizing other countries around the world for having regimes and mistreating their citizens and stuff. You know, out of the 40s, with Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, called them fascists, you know, and so forth. And they were just as fascist as Mussolini and Hitler were. They were just as fascist, you know. And, you know, World War One, World War Two, is so many things. You know, go back to Du Bois and the foundation of the NAACP and also the foundation of what they referred to as the Boule. You know, the oldest black fraternity. You know. Let me see if it's Omega Psi Phi, whatever it is. But anyway, 1904 and then 1907, Du Bois in Philadelphia. And these individuals, Philip Randolph, Bayard Rustin had some influence on Dr. King. And Bayard Rustin has great influence on him. And to my understanding, it was Bayard Rustin who had taught or poured into Dr. King Gandhiism, you know, named after Mahatma Gandhi, who was a nonviolent leader of the black and brown people, or the brown people, rather, of the country, subcontinent of India and Central Asia. That the colonialism on the part of the British, the imperialism on the part of the British that had been transporting, you know, Indians, you know, to places such as Southern Africa, the workers were referred to as coolies, you know, which was no more nor less than a strategy to keep the imbalance between black and brown people. It's sort of like here in America where, you know, you take brown people and pit them against black people, you know, Mexicans or Latinos or whatnot, and pit them against the blacks. And so the white ruling class can, you know, stay safe, you know, keep their structure intact. It's a similar tactic and strategy that they used then, you know, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, whatnot, you know. And so Bayard Rustin had introduced Martin Luther King to Gandhiism. And this is how he had shaped his nonviolent civil rights movement. And, of course, being a minister, you know, a reverend, you know, fluent in scripture, what have you. And, of course, the upbringing from his parents, and his parents had come out of that middle-class structure that Malcolm was critical of, what we call the Negro bourgeoisie. You know, he had been critical of those who had come along, and instead of shaking things up, they cut deals or had a relationship with the white ruling class establishment. And of course, you know, the Rockefellers, as I've mentioned, had been pretty much in the thick of things. One of the front families for a more even powerful group, you know, part of that structure. You know, this is how the civil rights movement had been shaped. You know, it could go no further than what they was allowed to do unless they would risk putting everything on the line, you know. Like Ho Chi Minh did in Vietnam, like Chairman Mao did in China, like Castro had done in Cuba, like Cabral had done in Guinea-Bissau, West Africa, like the leadership of the FLN had done in Algeria, and so forth, like Zapata and Pancho Villa had done in Mexico. They were willing to put it all on the line, and weren't had moved beyond, we're not trying to entertain this piecemeal kind of shit. You know, this sort of deal making, this structure where, you know, you can have autonomy and self-rule, but you don't control the power. That's crazy. They weren't having that shit, you know. But that is what, you know, took place, you know. And Coakley would constantly, you know, talk about that. He would talk about the things that was not being put out in public media, you know, that you were not going to get on a larger platform where millions of people could hear the shit. You know, so this is how he got to exposing us to, you know, what eventually became known as the Boule. And that the white ruling class, whenever they needed somebody black to give a position to, then they would pick somebody from the Boule, because they had it in their minds that they were not any threat to anything. There's a picture in recent times. I believe this picture goes back maybe to the 90s, I believe, where, you know, they have their annual, you know, they have this big, huge gathering. And I was told that the only white man in the room was David Rockefeller. And, of course, David Rockefeller has had a history of New World Order control. Him and some other old white men whose purpose was to dominate the natural resources of the planet due to the whims of their capitalist appetite. And I'll say it again, capitalism has and shall ever be the enemy of black and brown people. That we can't point nowhere on the planet and find black and brown people having a good time of it under capitalism. Only the small, tiny minority that capitalism has found room to allow to exist. And this has been the grave problem here in America. And this is why you had such groups that rose up as revolutionaries. The Black Panther Party, which was deemed the most dangerous organization in the history of America. And they had gotten the treatment that the other organizations didn't get. The SCLC, of course, was Martin Luther King's group, NAACP and so forth, you know, core Congress of Racial Equality, Urban League and so forth, you know, Roy Ennis and Whitney Young, who were the heads of those groups and organizations. And of course, the Black Panther Party had been influenced by the philosophy and ideology, militancy of Robert Williams, who had instructed the people in his neck of the woods on self-defense, because the government wasn't willing to protect its own citizens, who happened to be black and brown people, you know, from the mob, you know, from the extension of what the Black Panther Party called the pig, and the extension of the state, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. And so Robert Williams had started teaching the men and the women, you know, in North Carolina, you know, and they developed, you know, the gun club. And today you see several gun clubs, you know, black gun clubs are there in the militant faction of the movement, you know. And he was instrumental in the Black Panther Party developing the self-defense ideology on one end. On the other end, of course, you had the civil rights movement, you know. And so, you know, King being made the face of the civil rights movement. But there were times when it got hot, you know, shit had got hot. Of course, the Watts Rebellion in 65, you know, of course, his assassination, his murder, you know, in 1965. I mean, in 68, Malcolm X's assassination in 65. But, you know, there have been times where things have got hot. And this is what the white ruling classes are descendants of the slave masters, you know, that had been passed on to them in anticipation of. And so this period where you had a group called SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you know, which had those, you know, several, you know, leaders, presidents, whatnot, you know. At one point, this group had been headed by H.R.A.P. Brown, and you know, we were in the 80s or the 90s that we were we were sort of mystified by A-Trap Brown. You know, his name alone just, you know, appealed to us, you know, A-Trap Brown. You know, we were like, man, you know. And so instinctually, we just knew, like, man, this got to be a bad brother. But when he become president, nigga changed that nonviolent shit out of there and called it the Student National Coordinating Committee because he understood that violence was American as apple pie, knowing that black people had better get their minds right and cut out all that other shit with the people who historically had been violent with them, you know, and that is suicide, and that only a fool would stand by and not defend its own life. You know, his life, of course, you know, if the men ain't doing it, then where would that leave, you know, black women? That would leave them vulnerable to the winds, you know, of the white ruling class. And you even see that today. But, you know, this particular time, it was a meeting. It was a gathering that had taken place, you know. And there's another book that was actually written about SNCC. And to my understanding, maybe the top book on this group. It's called In Struggle, you know, subtitle, SNCC and the Black Awakening in the 1960s by Claiborne Carson. And Claiborne Carson was actually one of those young persons who had got involved, you know, when they started, you know, doing the sit-ins and shit. You know, young people, you know, like 18, 19, 20, 20 years old, you know. And this was a thing that the state had saw, and they saw, you know, its potential, what it could turn out to be, you know. And so they inserted, you know, leadership into it, or and I can't make this up, you know. You know, they always, you know, been watching that they would, again, make somebody the face of the shit. You know, they had a history of doing it. Malcolm X even talked about it. He said he went out down there to D.C. and he saw how the young black people was gathering. They were fired up, and that it wasn't really any one thing like talking about it. And according to him, that called the civil rights leaders and told them that they better get control of this thing, you know. A number of times it was done. And so another occasion, according to Claiborne Carson, in the book, and I'll just read there's a little section here. But he said, during this period, liberal financial backers of the civil rights movement took steps to unify black civil rights leaders and to slow down the turn toward militancy. And you read that again. During this period, liberal financial backers of the civil rights movement took steps to unify black civil rights leadership and to slow the turn towards militancy. Under direction of philanthropist Stephen Currier of the Taconic Foundation, a united Civil Rights Leadership Council was established to coordinate planning for the March on Washington. Currier raised $800,000 to be distributed among the major civil rights groups. The lure of financial support attracted SNCC into the coalition with leaders from the NAACP, Urban League, CORE, and SCLC. Okay, so I can't make this up. You know, there it is. You know, this has been a historic phenomenon. Just when it seemed black people then reached the brink and that we were willing to put it on the line to stop the collective mistreatment of black people. These forces, these unseen forces, had made a move on the chessboard and unfortunately had used people who look like us, as Claiborne Carson said, to slow the turn towards militancy. No. Robert Williams had been in the NAACP. And, you know, he's the lead of the chapter in Carolina. And in Monroe, they were saying that these people are firebombing black houses, you know, white terrorists, you know, who had been the foundation of terrorism. It had been the classic example of what terrorism is long before so-called Al-Qaeda. You know, and you know, they would appeal to the government. And Kennedy was president. And in that time, did they send any shit, any anything? It was only after, I believe, this a white youth had gotten killed, so something to that effect, that they would then send in, you know, the so-called National Guard or whatever. None. And all the time, you know, black people were thinking that Kennedy was the coolest white man president they had ever seen or witnessed in the history of white men presidents and stuff, you know. But that particular meeting, you know, was the hallmark of what we say selling out. And you couldn't get Malcolm X to be part of that. And so he went on a blitzkrieg, you know, and he would take every opportunity, you know, to drive the nail in the coffin. And so he would start talking about the Big Six, you know. And the streets is beginning to get it. You know, they begin to get it, you know. And the Black Panther Party had come the year after the Watts Rebellion. And some of us will say riot. And don't even realize what we're saying. You know, we'll correct that shit. That was a rebellion. You didn't hear them say the Boston Tea Party riot, did you? You don't read that nowhere, the Boston Tea Party riot. It may be somewhere, but I don't recall it as such. You know, but so this relationship between the white ruling class through philanthropy and the so-called civil rights movement. You know, and then, of course, the concessions, you know, the Civil Rights Act that passed, desegregation and all this kind of stuff, you know. Malcolm X, you know, had kept driving the point home, put violence in perspective. He had put, you know, master-slave relationship in perspective. He had put correct versus incorrect leadership and perspective when he talked about the house nigga and the field nigga. You know, the house nigga was so fond of his master that when the master got sick, he asked the master, what's wrong, master? Are we sick? When the master house caught on fire, you know, the house nigga had hustled quicker than the slave master himself to put out the fire. You know, that he knocked the master over trying to get to the bucket to get the water, you know, or the hose, where the field nigga was out in the field watching the house starting to burn, and the field nigga would drop everything in his hand and get down on his knees and pray to the God that he knew, that he'd always knew. And what would he pray to him for? Pray that the strong wind come and make the fire even worse, you know? And that goes back to the days of David Walker. David Walker's appeal in the 1830s, you know, late 20s or early 30s. You know, that era of black militancy, that had had enough of the treatment by the slave master, the inhumane, barbaric, savage, brutal treatment, uncivilized treatment on the part of the white ruling class and its function and its white functionaries, you know, doing physical slavery. And so you saw the rise of Nat Turner, you know, and the rise of Denmark Vesey and Gabriel Prosser, who were sold out, you know. And David Walker appealed, he wrote a small book, and it had inspired such individuals to take their lives back into their own hands, the same way that George Washington felt that they take their lives into their own hands as opposed to the British crown. You know, it's an incredible display in psychology here. You know? But the Black Panther Party, you know, they were practical, it was on point. Being called the sons and daughters of Malcolm X. And of course his assassination and the whodunit thing, the split with the Nation of Islam, and so forth. You know, Minister Louis Farrakhan, you know, calling for, you know, his head and so forth. You know, some believe that he was the one who stirred the pot, you know, that led to Malcolm's assassination and so forth. You know, the Vietnam War had been brewing and America was ripe for revolution. You know, you had the 68, I believe, you know, these presidential conventions and whatnot for the election of the next pig president, the head pig CEO, you know, and so forth. You know, you had the white radical militant groups, SDS, and there were these alliances with the black militant movement. You had the Weather Underground, who committed revolutionary acts of violence by what they referred to as strategic you know, bombings of federal installations and whatnot, due to their hatred for the system, due to their hatred for capitalism and the draconian rulership of the white ruling class and so forth. You had the Black Revolutionary Underground, the Black Liberation Army, you know. And so it was ripe for revolutionary change, you know. And, of course, the assassination of Kennedy in 63 and then Johnson taking over and this passage of this civil rights legislation, you know, so forth. But Malcolm X kept hammering the weight. You know, and, of course, his split, he had gotten a chance to go to Mecca and see the larger world of Islam, Muslims, you know, from around the world or whatnot. And a lot of people tried to say that Malcolm had changed and so forth, but Malcolm didn't really change. He just enlarged the scope of his thinking and got to the point where he had even found room to want to work with those who were serious about changing the lives and conditions of black people. And so the one time that he had to meet with Martin Luther King, they crossed paths for a few minutes and he spoke. And a lot of people were excited. They were excited over that. And they saw the combining of two great black men, one who had been revolutionary in his philosophy and ideology from one, and he continued to stay that way. In the meantime, Martin Luther King began to see the futility of his Gandhiism, of his nonviolent philosophy. And the whites had always contradicted him. The whites had always proved him wrong by their behavior, that they had educated him, you know, like Mugabe had been educated by the colonialist sickness of the British in what is now Zimbabwe, you know. And Dr. King used to have these conversations or this person that he would could confide in, you know, behind the scenes or in private or whatever, you know. And this one person was Harry Belafonte, who had made a name for himself as an actor. He had played in one of the good movies. Can't think the name of it. Sidney Poitier. It slips from my mind, but you know, as a matter of fact, they've been playing this movie as of late. You know, where, you know, they portray, you know, the period where the blacks were migrating, and that the slave bounty hunters, you know, were out, you know, to bring them back into the fold and so forth, and they were trying to cross into this other territory and whatnot. Bucking the preach. You know, so they played in this movie together, but Dr. King began to realize the futility of it all. And according to Harry Belafonte, he had told him that he had led his people into a burning house, into an integrating burning house. You know, there's been those who have pounced on that. You know, there's been those who have taken that, you know, the drive Martin Luther King into the ground, you know. It was a hardcore, hard line that some of us have taken today. And, you know, it's understandable, you know, because, you know, to lead millions of people in a direction that end up being a burning fucking house is not a good thing. It doesn't leave a good taste in our mouths, you know. And so integration began to be realized as a pawn in the game. And Stokely Carmichael, who had become later known as Kwame Ture, who had moved to Africa and had started the All African People's Revolutionary Party, had spoke, you know, he would size up these acts that the white man so-called passed that would ease the pain and suffering of black people and put black people on the right road, equality and justice and all this kind of shit, and guarantee them the freedoms and the rights and the Constitution and so forth, which has always been bullshit and will forever be bullshit, because it's about power. You know, when that Constitution was being formulated and put together, it was no niggas at the table behind those closed doors. And the white men who was behind those closed doors were property owners. And they owned shares, including George Washington. They were property owners. But those who into the conspiratorial side of it, you know, most of those white men who were behind closed doors and the signers of that Constitution were Freemasons. But there was no niggas at the table, you know. So it would be rather farcical to believe that these white men somehow would have a Jesus moment and in turn lose their holdings and spread the wealth. That is not the way capitalism works. The only spreading of the wealth is through philanthropy or through the private industry, which serves its own purpose. Capitalism in America began by the force of violence and using force to build up this infrastructure that you see today. There was never a time that those rich white men ever considered in real time in their hearts what they claim to believe about universal brotherhood. It read well on paper. It was a Machiavellian ploy to induce the masses into getting them to believe that they were equals, and from time to time appease them to keep them cool and so forth. Eldridge Cleaver referred to as shelling out the dough. When things got hot, they shelled out the dough to cool black people down. The Vietnam War had put things in perspective also. The first whistleblower, to my understanding, had exposed the Pentagon Papers and so forth about the Vietnam War and how the Vietnam War was unwinnable. But they had to keep selling it and selling it and selling it because they had gotten to the point that they had become outmatched and so forth. The Viet Cong guerrilla revolutionary war led by Ho Chi Minh and his right-hand man, Vo Nguyen Giap. They had developed the ideology, the personality, the belief system in their heart and soul about people's war, people's army, and that they had realized that it's either now or never, and that if we didn't do nothing and they get our land and get these imperialists out of here, then our children's children would be slaves to these capitalists. And so their minds were made up. And some people understand, Malcolm X used to talk about that and say that these high-tech whites had got beaten by a bunch of rice eaters who had started off with bows and arrows. But it was the spirit of the Vietnamese people who refused to lose. And so that spirit has also been in such black brothers and sisters as Fred Hampton, Cy Shakur, who is still in exile in Cuba as we speak today. You know what I'm saying? Martin Luther King had begun to come face to face with reality. And so we had wanted to give another speech, and according to Stokely Carmichael, he called him personally and told him that he wanted him front and center to hear his speech. And so this was the some would say an anti-Vietnam War speech and so forth, and of course other things were said at other times, and people started to get this feeling that Dr. King had begun to turn, especially when he talked about the masses, the white ruling class, capitalists, and so forth. He had talked about how they give the masses capitalism, and among themselves they practice socialism. And so some have took that and began to use that as their central piece to say that this is the new Dr. King, who had become a militant that you're leaning in the direction of a Malcolm X or whatnot. And the individuals that he had already been with, there's a photo with Dr. King and Stokely Carmichael at the time and Willie Ricks. when they were doing their, you know, their marches and whatnot, and, you know, on the road and stuff. And I had a chance to ask Baba Mukasa now, as he's known now, formerly known as Willie Ricks, and I had a chance to, you know, meet him, you know, and he was so, so cool, so down to earth, you know, and you ask him anything, you ask him questions, and that was that was the question I would just ask him, how in the world did you and Stokely Carmichael were able to find some kind of combination here, considering, you know, you were y'all were the ones who started the Black Power chant and slogan in Lowndes County in rural Mississippi, and had been the ones who became the first Black Panthers, you know? The evolution of the Black Panther logo that you see today, you know? And he said, well, we had to, because of the white violent, you know, population, the white race of the violent whites, you know, the viciousness of them. But he clearly understood Black Power. He clearly understood it. And to a point where he talked about Black Power being sort of the vanguard of Black people. You know, but then there's that word but, you know. And so he appears to have had it in it. And it must have been this relationship, you know, because there's an explanation for all of this shit. You have to, you know, you have to look at these relationships that had been established, especially between Dr. King and at the time, I believe it was Nelson Rockefeller, you know, who was running for president. I think he had been the governor of Arkansas or New York or something like that. This is where they get the Rockefeller laws from, you know, that disproportionately target Black and brown people into the concentration camp system of America, you know. Some are not aware of the fact that when Nelson Rockefeller was running for president, he had, you know, that there's this, you know, this strategy where, you know, those who are wealthy enough can afford a train, you know, and take a train all over the country. And there's been a time or two when Dr. King was on this train, you know. When Dr. King had gotten stabbed, you know, I guess one of the attempts on his life, to my understanding, it was, you know, Nelson Rockefeller that called the hospital and said, you know, you pretty much, you treat him like it's me and send me the bill. You know, so there's these, you wash my back, I wash your back kind of thing. The march across the James Pettus Bridge, the first time, you know, the brutal beat down that the civil rights leaders had got, you know, Alvin Atkin and whatnot, who had gotten cracked in the skull or something, and, you know, they had gotten brutally beaten, where these white men had told them, look, you know, you niggas turn around or you're going to regret it. And they called themselves trying to lock arms and kneel down as though something miraculously was going to stop those bullets from busting them in the head. Now, I don't say that out of facetiousness, out of, you know, I understand full well that there are certain powers that are at play, that specific moment in time. But what I'm saying is the non-violent approach to people who are violent with them, you know, it's like suicide. And this first attempt, there was no Dr. King. And it was a second attempt. Then there was Dr. King. And there was no beat down the second time. You know, they went across that march with no problem. And you got to ask yourself, well, how is that possible? You know, how is that possible? You know? And I believe that Malcolm X used to talk about these things and how they would make these phone calls and, you know, cut deals and whatnot, you know, with the Kennedys and Johnson and all these people, whatever. You know? And this is that point where, you know, Dr. King must have, you know, start realizing that this has failed, you know, that, you know, another alternative has to be taken here. You know, in the meantime, Malcolm X is doing this thing and, you know, like working on some UN shit, traveling around the world, you know, putting America on trial, you know, on center stage. And so, you know, this Martin Luther King who appears to have begin to transform, you know, you see today the ones who profess to keep his spirit alive, you have to ask if they transform. You know, the militancy or the apparent militancy that began to creep into the philosophy of Martin Luther King's attitude or whatnot, and then being gunned down and cut off. And so the baton had been dropped due to his assassination. So who's picked it up? And who's ever picked it up? Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. And so the question is, you know, have they betrayed Dr. King, the latter stage Dr. King, or the Dr. King that was to become, you know, that militant Dr. King?
Black Power, Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead, Conrad. What we got?
I always had a question as related to the Dr. King assassination. Like, check this out. When JFK was assassinated, when a bullet hit his face, we saw like damn near half of his face was damn near blown off, right? Because the shot came from in front of him. Now on that legendary picture that shows Dr. King after he had been shot and everybody is pointing, or the bullet came from over there. So if the bullet came from where they pointed at, that means the same effects from the John F. Kennedy shots. You know, that means Dr. King's face would have been blown off too. So if the bullet came from in front of him, how did he get shot underneath his neck? And he still lived when he got to the hospital, because, you know, we found out later in life that he died not from the bullet, but he died because he was suffocated. So if the bullet came from according to that picture, that means his face was supposed to be damn near blown off like John F. Kennedy's face was.
I become aware of that myself, even to the point where Jesse Jackson was pointing in the wrong direction. When Jesse Jackson was on the ground, though, and that is funny how Dr. King had told him when they were going out to dinner that he wanted them to wear, you know, something like, you know, wear a tie, you know, and they didn't wear a tie, and that he wore one, you see. And so Reverend Billy Cowles, who was up on that balcony with him, as gave, they do these little commemorations, you know, whatever, I don't know if it's every year or whatever, something like that, but there's a little speech he gave one time some years ago. And he actually, some say let the cat out the bag right there. You know, well, when he was speaking, and he was just talking and whatnot, and how Dr. King was a joker. He played pranks on him and whatnot and stuff like that. And then he go in to talk about the assassination, you know, them up on the balcony and whatnot. He actually went to, like, using his, you know, his thing about showing, like, where he was standing, you know, how close and whatnot, and positioned Dr. King. And he put one finger up and said, well, as I was standing here and Dr. King was standing here and that, and as I moved over so they can get a good shot out of his own mouth, just like that. And Dick Gregory was aware of it because a young person had called him. And the first thing Dick Gregory had said that, well, we got to get the video to tape for NBC realize what was said. You know, so they were able to get a copy of him. Then Dick Gregory started going on this speaking gig. He spoke somewhere, and he spoke to a large crowd of people. And then he started talking about the same thing that Malcolm X is talking about, that there's somebody, you know, is dirty here. Somebody is dirty, you know. Somebody is dirty, and they look just like us, you know. But, yeah, Reverend Billy Cox said out of his own mouth. I was standing here, Dr. King was standing here, and then I moved over so they can get a good shot, you know, and that was it. But it's just something about the ties, you know, like, as though, shit, I ain't wearing no tie, you know. Jesse Jackson was on the ground, and Andrew Jackson was up there. Andrew Jackson was the one who was sitting down, leaning, you know, on the ground or the floor or the balcony or whatever, there up against the wall or whatever, and Dr. King's body was, like, right there. He said that Jesse Jackson had came over and literally put his hand in Dr. King's blood and wiped it on his shirt. He said this in the interview some years later, you know, back in, I don't know if anybody might have been back in the 90s or something. He said it out of his own mouth. He said Jesse Jackson came over, put his hand in Dr. King's blood and wiped it on his shirt. And then when the reporters came, the news media came, and he was given some instruction about nobody speaking to the meeting. And here Jesse Jackson is down there on the ground talking to the media. So the reporter asked him how he got the blood on his shirt. And he perjured himself. He told the reporter that he had held Dr. King in his arms. And he was asking for a ride. Can anybody give him a ride to the hospital? You see all this on video. You know, but yeah, the trajectory of the shot, you know, it's been suspect from one. You know what I'm saying? Just like the murder of Malcolm X, same similar shit, you know, military operation, you know, military intelligence and stuff. I mean, they conducted military intelligence against the Black Panther Party too, you know. But we got a couple minutes. We want to, like I say, you know, the betrayal of Dr. King, the latter stage Dr. King that has been betrayed, you know, by those who still try to keep him alive. You know, they still every, you know, year they get this parade and they play the same old recording, the same old speeches, but they don't introduce our young people to the latter stage Dr. King, who had become anti-capitalist, you know, realizing the state was what it was, you know, and that his approach had himself, like he said, like he integrated into a burning house, you know, or the future or the fate of America, and what it would now take for Black people to alleviate their problems, you know. And so the betrayal of Dr. King today by all those who profess to love the man so much. And yet, did they transform? Dr. King transformed? Did they transform? And if they did, then you should hear a much more militant message. You should hear them speak to our young people when they go to the universities, even if it's a Black college, and talking about what capitalism really is and how capitalism is the enemy. And it will continue to be the enemy. You know, and there's still this force, that this cabal in our midst. That what Coakley was talking about, they're still in operation, and you know, they're still willing to do the devil's drudgery, you know, like some people state, you know, using that type of language. And we talk about Boule, and let's say this, for let's make this clear, that everybody that's part of the Boule or trying to get into Boule may not necessarily be aware of the central thesis of the Boule. You know, it was supposed to be a Greek term, which was supposed to mean protectors of the king, which the Greeks had used, or the protectors of the higher class in Greece, you know, be a buffer zone against the lower class people, you know. But on that note, we're going to end. We be black next week, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, in Defense of the People Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party, one of your hosts, Chairman Nat, and my co-host, Brother Motherland, our National Minister of Defense. Now, I saw a technician engineer on the ones, too, Sister Amado Shun, our National Minister of Communication. We say black power to black people, specifically all power to the people. Your rule, we be black next week.
And we're on news today.
Thing. Yo, look at Grinch with them stupid bell bottom pants, man.
Your shoes, man. They make you look like a fool.
Word.
While you jive, churches, I'll knock you through Sunday and be waiting for you on Monday. You're too young to have seen the sights of Esther Mammy and Pappy about Dolomite.
Planet Earth was my place of birth. Born to be the sole controller of the universe. Inside the part of the map, I hit first. Any environment, I can adapt. When it gets worse, the rough gets going, the going gets rough. When I start blowing the mic.